I thought she was gone. Kim said she had clients in from out of town and she was off showing property. I don't know where she got that. Nancy's right around the corner. I didn't press the point. As much as I'd have loved to get Kim in hot water, I wanted to stay on track. Here's the other thing, I said. The night I was up there, the place was fully furnished, lots of oriental carpets and paintings on the walls. She had deck chairs and outdoor heaters. Where did all that come from? It's called staging. Common practice in real estate. If a house goes on the market unfurnished, the feeling is that most buyers who tour an empty house lack the imagination to see the possibilities. A stager will show an appealing living room arrangement and set up the dining table and chairs, complete with table linens, flatware, and a centerpiece. Sometimes a buyer even asks to have the furniture included in the purchase price. Isn't that expensive? Quite. So, if Hallie hired a stager to furnish the house short-term, who paid for it? She would have, I guess, though the cost would have been prohibitive. I believe you said this was for one night, yes? More or less. I met her at the house last Monday, and there was stuff everywhere. Now it's empty, I said. Why prohibitive? A stager has to maintain a large inventory of furniture because they're often handling 8 or 10 big houses at the same time. Part of their overhead is the warehouse space for items not in use. That gets factored into the client's overall cost. There's also the expense of moving furniture into a house and then out again at the end of a contract. In this case, that's a lot of time and effort. I wonder if any of the neighbors saw the moving van. In that area? Doubtful. On the other hand, all she had to do was create the illusion of furnished rooms. How much of the house did you actually see? Not much, now that you mention it. The furniture in the living room and dining rooms were largely covered in tarps. I guess there could have been old cardboard boxes under them. Sleight of hand, she said. I can't believe I fell for it. You're fortunate in one respect. Under ordinary circumstances, you wouldn't have caught on to the trick at all. You'd have tracked down the information, sent off your report, and that would have been the end of it. If that police detective hadn't come into your office with the story about the marked bills, you'd still be in the dark. You think there's any point trying to find the stager? Probably not. We all know one or two, but there's no formal list. Hallie either paid handsomely or the stager was doing her a personal favor. It's also possible she didn't need outside help at all. She might have brought in all the items from home. I said a bad word, but Catherine Phillips never flinched. This is probably what comes of having a grown son who works for the police department. Soon afterward, I rounded out our chat with a few incidental questions and then excused myself. I didn't see any point in talking to Nancy Harkness. Catherine Phillips had been more than generous with her time, and my curiosity was tapped out. Hallie Betancourt had taken me for a ride for reasons that eluded me. I'd have to give the situation some serious thought before I decided what to do next. In light of the $100 bill I'd forfeited, I was already in the hole, and I couldn't see what there was to be gained by pushing the point. When I passed the front desk on my way out, Kim Bass, receptionist, was nowhere to be seen. This was fortunate, as I was so irritated with the way she treated me, I might have bitten her on the arm. I'd been a biter as a kid, and I can still remember the feel of flesh between my teeth. It's like biting a rubber bathing cap, in case you're curious. Chapter 12. When I arrived back at the office, Henry was sitting on my front step with a handful of papers. Ever the gentleman, he rose to his feet as I approached. "I've been playing with Pete's number grid," he said. "You broke the code?" "Not yet, but I have an idea. If I take a look at your Smith Corona, I can tell you if I'm right." "Sure thing," I said. I unlocked the door and he followed me in. I continued on into my inner office, talking over my shoulder. "I thought I gave you a key. Why didn't you let yourself in?" "I might have if you hadn't shown up when you did. Otherwise, it would have seemed cheeky." "God forbid," I remarked. I put down my shoulder bag, pushed aside my swivel chair, and hauled my typewriter from the knee space under my desk. I placed it on top, removed the lid, and then turned the machine so it was facing him. He sat down in one of my two visitors' chairs and placed his papers on the desk to his left. The top sheet was the graph paper where Pete had recorded his grid of numbers. Henry reached for one of my letter-size yellow legal pads and jotted a column of numbers along the left margin, 1 through 26. I could see his eyes trace a line back and forth between the keyboard and the grid. I walked around the desk so I could look over his shoulder. He was clearly pleased with himself. Good man! I knew he was doing something of the sort. Pull up a chair and take a look. I scooted the second chair closer and sat down. Henry said, Remember I said this was probably a number letter substitution code? I figured chances were good he used a format of some kind, a matrix or a template that would govern the assignment of a particular number to a given letter. He could have done this any number of ways. He might have written the alphabet, A, B, C, D, and so forth, and then used 1 for A, 2 for B, 3 for C down the line. Pete constructed his cipher along other lines, which is what I've been trying to pin down. Swapping one number per letter would make it 26 altogether, yes? Right. What about that number, the 1909, I said, pointing to a four-number group. Henry said, I suspect that's the number 19 followed by the number 9. I am theorizing Pete put a 0 in front of any letter between 1 and 9, so 03 is something, and 04 is the next in the sequence, whatever the sequence is. I guess you have to start somewhere. It's basically trial and error, though if you do these often enough, you get a feel for what's going on. The obvious system where 1 is A, 2 is B, and so forth didn't work, which didn't surprise me in the least. Pete was too wily for something so simplistic, so I said to myself, what's next? As kids, we used a system called Rotate 1, which means that B becomes A, C becomes B, and so forth. I experimented with that and a few other well-known systems and got nowhere. And then I wondered if this could be a keyboard pattern, which is why I needed your Smith Corona. He looked up with a sly smile, tapping the paper with his pen. This is a QWERTY code, starting with the top row of letters on a typewriter. Read left to right and keep on going. Q is 1, W is 2, E is 3, or 03, the way he writes it. R is 4, or 04. You'll see I'm completing that first row of letters and then starting again left to right, moving down all three rows. The last row is Z, X, C, V, B, N. Do you see what I'm doing here? M is the last letter, which in this format makes it the 26th. Just tell me what it says. Henry rolled his eyes. So impatient. Give me a minute and I'll write it out for you. You want some coffee? Only if you're making some, he said, distracted. He was already busy writing down the letters he matched with the numbers on the grid. I left him where he was and went down the hall to the kitchenette, where I picked up the coffee pot and filled it with water. I poured the water into the reservoir and then opened a packet of coffee, the grounds neatly sealed in a filter that I tucked into the basket. I flipped the switch and stood there until I could hear the gurgling begin. Moments later, I placed both mugs of coffee on my desk and resumed my seat. Henry was still translating, so I waited for him to finish. This is a list of names, he said. 6 of them. I'll start with the first. You see the numbers 1216, then 0804, and so forth. The 12 is the letter S, followed by 16, which is the letter H. Here, 08 is the letter I, followed by 04, which is the letter R. I won't go through every single grouping. Trust me when I tell you the first name is Shirley Ann Castle. The line under her name reads Burning Oaks, California, with a state abbreviated. Never heard of her. Next is the number series starting with 1903-2509 and on down the line. This line spells the name Lenore Redfern, also from Burning Oaks, California, which is the line under the name. I believe hers was the name written in the Bible you found. April's mother, I said. It looks like she wanted April to have her Bible and the other items. I'm not sure why she mailed them to the priest unless he was supposed to hold them and pass them on in due course. According to April's wedding announcement, Ned's now married to a woman named Celeste. Go on, I didn't mean to slow you down. The third name is Phyllis Joplin, Perdido, California. Again, the state abbreviated. Are you familiar with the name?
Nope.
Under her name, if you look at my cheat sheet, you'll see that 05 is T, the number 11 is A, 04 is R, 06 is Y. I checked the next number in the sequence. And 25 is N, and the name is Taryn, I said. I knew exactly who this was. Surname is Sizemore. That's right. He's written Santa Teresa, California on the line beneath, so she must be local. You know her? She was the plaintiff in the lawsuit I mentioned earlier. Much of this seems to hark back to that lawsuit, he said. Could be coincidental. Possible. Fifth name on the list is Susan Telford, who apparently lives in Henderson, Nevada. Ring a bell? Nada. Henry said, speaking Spanish now, very nice. I pointed to the next sequence of numbers. Who's that? Last name is Janet Macy in Tucson, Arizona, which doesn't ring any bells. I thought about the names for a moment. I can't imagine what the relationship is among these women. It might help if you talk to someone in Burning Oaks. Father Xavier would be the obvious choice. I am not planning to do anything unless I figure out what Pete had in mind. I'm not sure how you'll arrive at that. I gather he didn't confide in Ruthie, at least where this business is concerned, he said. Is that a copy machine?
It is.
Henry picked up the single sheet of graph paper and the yellow pad, crossed to the machine, and pushed the power button. While he waited for the machine to warm up, he neatly tore off the top two sheets of lined yellow paper, and when the ready light went on, he opened the cover, placed the first sheet face down on the glass plate, and lowered the cover again. He pushed print, and we stared, transfixed, as a line of light moved down the page, and a copy emerged from the innards of the machine. I didn't have a clue how the process worked. He then copied the second sheet, and last he made a copy of the grid of numbers. When he finished, he handed me the originals and folded the copies, putting them in the pockets of his shorts. Indicating the first sheet he'd given me, he said, "That's the key, written down the left-hand margin. The QWERTY letters with a number value next to each. You come across any other eight-place grids, you should be able to translate. I'm not sure what you'll do with the names, but I'll leave you to ponder the possibilities."
"I'll do that, and thanks."
"I enjoyed watching Pete's mind at work," he said. "Nearly forgot to mention, I had a plumber out this morning to take a look at the irrigation issue. He was full of good advice. He kept saying, reduce before reuse."
"You already knew that," I said. "Nothing practical?"
"You want to hear his recommendation? Tear out the lawn. Get rid of all the grass. It's dead anyway," was what he said. He recommended AstroTurf. Can you imagine it? Well, it would be green all year round. I told him I'd think about it and get back to him. Then I put a call through to someone else. At any rate, I'll see you back at the house. Once he left, I sat and chewed on the significance of what I'd learned. Henry had provided the key to the list without supplying the point. Pete's purpose wasn't obvious, but the six women must have had something in common. The fact that he'd encrypted the names suggested he thought the list worth protecting, but I had no idea why. Who did he imagine might come across information so sensitive that he couldn't leave it in plain English? I picked up the handset and punched in Ruthie's phone number. The machine picked up, and I dutifully left a message at the sound of the beep. "Hi, Ruthie. Sorry I missed you. This is Kinsey with another update. Henry's broken the code, and I'll tell you what it says when you have a minute. Meanwhile, the files are here at the office. I'll search again if you think there's any point. Fat chance, in my view. But you're the boss. Hope your appointment went well. Give me a call as soon as you get home. I'm panting to hear. I stacked the sheets, folded them, and put them in my bag. More from curiosity than anything else, I pulled out the telephone book and checked the white pages for residential listings in hopes of spotting Taryn Sizemore. In the 10 years since the lawsuit, she might have married, died, or left town, in which case there'd be no sign of her. Under the S's, I found 10 Sizemores, none of whom were T or Taryn. I shifted my search to the business section of the white pages and found her. Sizemore, Taryn, Ph.D. No clue as to the field she was in. College professor? Educational consultant? She might be an audiologist or a speech therapist. The address was in downtown Santa Teresa with a phone number. I pulled out my index cards, made a note, and then replaced the rubber band and returned the cards to my bag. I was still torn. What in heaven's name was Pete Walensky up to? Probably nothing good. If he was extorting money from the women on the list, then lucky them. He was dead and they wouldn't have to pay another cent. If he was operating from other motives, then what? It would behoove me to chat with Taryn Sizemore in hopes she had some idea what was going on. I was in information-gathering mode, and I'd make a decision when I had a few more facts in hand. In the meantime, when it came to Hallie Betancourt, I was concerned that in passing along Christian Satterfield's contact information, I might have put him in harm's way. At the very least, I felt I should alert him that he'd been the subject of the inquiry. I locked the office and hoofed it to the Santa Teresa dispatch, which was 6 blocks away. I needed the air, and the exercise allowed me to free up my brain. I thought I was correct in estimating Hallie's social status. She looked like big bucks, and she carried herself with a classy air that was impossible to fake. How did she know about Christian Satterfield, and what did she want from him? Unless she hoped to supplement her income by robbing banks, I couldn't imagine how locating a parolee would serve her. When I reached the dispatch building, I went into the lobby and took the stairs to the second floor. The newspaper archives were housed in an area dense with file cabinets, the drawers packed with news clippings dating back to the 1800s. The librarian was a woman named Marjorie Hickson, who was in her 80s. Tall and refined, gray-green eyes, high cheekbones, gray hair streaked with white. I dealt with her on many occasions, and I'd always found her cooperative and down-to-earth. "How are you doing, Marjorie? It's been a while," I said. "This place is a madhouse and has been for months. Last July, we moved from paper to a newfangled electronic system, words, pictures, and graphics, including maps. Don't ask me how it's done. I have no idea. I'm still partial to an old-fashioned card catalog, but that's beside the point. We used to have drones typing headlines on envelopes as they stuffed stories into them. The files were even cross-indexed, which I thought was fancy enough. Now an extraordinarily patient soul named John Pope ensures new stuff is transcribed from paper into an electronic format. All way over my head. Hey, mine too. I don't even own a computer. I have an old Mac my son-in-law passed along when he bought his new one, but I can't make heads or tails of it. He says it's user-friendly, but I've got news for him. Time was I could have mastered the darn thing in a day or two, but now there's no way. Might be time to retire. I'll be 88 August 19th, and my best years may well be behind me. I'm sure that's not true. You know more than anyone else around here. Well, I thank you for the vote of confidence, but I'm not too sure. This is a young man's game. Reporters and editors these days are all kids in their 50s. Too much ambition and energy for my taste. They cuss, they wear jeans to work, and most can't spell without help. But they dearly love their jobs, which is more than I can say. But what would you do if you retired? You'd go nuts. That's a worry, now you mention it. I'm not one for needlework, and you can only read so many books before your eyesight fails. Someone suggested volunteer work, but that's out of the question. I'm accustomed to being paid, and the idea of giving away my time and my skills is an affront. Braver women than I fought decades for equal compensation in the workplace, so why would I undo their accomplishments? Anyway, I doubt you came here to hear me complain. What can I do for you? I wrote the name Christian Satterfield on a slip of paper and pushed it across the counter. I'd like to see the file on this guy. I have two clippings, but I'm hoping there's more. She read the name. Let me see what I can find. Within minutes, I was seated at a desk along the side wall with the envelope in front of me. There wasn't much in it beyond the articles Hallie had passed on to me. The only other item of note was a brief mention of an academic scholarship he'd been awarded on graduating from Santa Teresa High School in 1975. He'd been accepted at UCLA, where he hoped to major in economics. The guy was smart, and if his photograph was representative, good-looking as well. How had he ended up in prison? I had classmates, dull-witted, dope-smoking losers, who'd ended up better off than he had. I returned the folder to Marjorie. I have a question. I believe someone came in making a similar request for information about this guy. This would have been a woman in her 40s, tall, thin, masses of red-brown hair, a beaky nose, the sort of face you'd see in a snooty magazine ad. I'd remember someone of that description. Of course, I was out on vacation over Christmas, and she could have come in then, she said. I can ask around if you like. Someone might remember her. We don't get much business up here these days. One day soon, newspapers will be a thing of the past. That can't be true, you think? I mean, people want to know what's going on the world. A television broadcast is never going to take the place of hard news. All I know is there was a time when a newspaper was the heartbeat of the city. Now, not so much. It's like the lifeblood is draining out. Well, that's depressing. Try looking at it from where I stand, she said. Chapter 13. I walked back to the office and retrieved my car. I had time for one more stop before I headed home. I checked my index cards to verify Taryn Sizemore's address. I cruised upstate and turned right onto a side street, approaching a bar and grill called Sneaky Pete's, which had closed and reopened under a new name some years before. Despite the new moniker, it was still referred to as Sneaky Pete's. What loomed large in my mind's eye was the vision of the specialty of the house. A sandwich made with spicy salami and melted pepperjack cheese, topped with a fried egg, the whole of it served on a Kaiser roll that dripped with butter as you ate. I would have pursued that fantasy, but I spotted Taryn Sizemore's office address directly across the street. I had to make a hasty turn at the next corner and swing back around. It was well after 5 by then, and many of the area businesses were closed for the day, which made street parking a breeze. I locked my car and entered the renovated Victorian structure, which apparently now housed an entire complex of psychologists' offices. From this, I cleverly deduced that Terrence's PhD must be in marriage and family therapy, counseling, or social work. She'd probably had years of professional training in how to feign interest in what others had to say. This might work to my advantage until she realized I wasn't in the market for a shrink. Hers was Suite 100 on the ground floor. I went in and found myself in a small, comfortably furnished waiting room, complete with an apartment-size, chintz-covered love seat and two small, easy chairs. The color scheme was a soothing blend of blues and greens, probably designed to calm clients whose emotional tendencies ran to upset and agitation. There were no windows and only one other door, which, I assumed, opened into her office proper. To the right of the door was a glowing red light. I took this to mean she was currently occupied. It was dead quiet. I checked my watch, hoping I hadn't missed the boat altogether. It was 5:25. It was my understanding that therapists operated on a 50-minute hour, but I had no idea when the hour began. I sat down, noting that she subscribed to 6 women's magazines, all current. I picked up a copy of House and Garden and turned to an article about easy Easter-themed entertaining for 8, then realized I don't know 8 people, let alone eight who'd suffer my cooking even if I invited them. After 15 minutes passed, I got up and tiptoed to the door, listening for sounds from within. No comforting murmur of conversation, no shrieks or sobs. I sat down again. Having arrived without an appointment, I didn't feel I had the right to bang on the door and complain. It was always possible she'd left for the day, but surely she'd have locked the front door. At 6:10, the light switched abruptly from red to green. No one emerged. There must be a separate outside exit, so a Looney Tunes patient was never subjected to the indignity of crossing paths with another nut job. At 6, the door to her office opened, and a young woman appeared at a brisk pace. She stopped dead when she caught sight of me. "Oh, sorry. I didn't know anybody was out here." She turned and glanced at the room behind her in dismay. "Do you have an appointment?" "I don't. I stopped by on the off chance I might catch you before you left for the day. Are you Ms. Sizemore?" She held out her hand. "Taryn, yes." Should I have said Dr. Sizemore? "Taryn's fine. Even with a PhD, I don't call myself doctor anything. It seems pretentious." "Kinsey Milhone," I said as the two of us shook hands. "Do you have a few minutes?" I watched her make a quick decision. "I have to be somewhere at 7, but I can give you until 6:30 if that helps." "That would be great. Come on in." She turned on her heel and I followed her into her office, waiting while she closed the door behind us. She was tall and lean, towering over me in black high-heeled boots. She wore a short white knit top over jeans that were belted low on her hips. A strip of bare midriff flashed when she moved. Her pant legs were long enough to break across her instep, which made her slim legs look even longer. I took in the rest of the picture as she crossed to the telephone and activated the message machine. Dark eyes, shoulder-length brown hair arranged in a messy tumble. Big hoop earrings, red lipstick. I did a visual survey of my surroundings. This room had the same homey feel as the reception area. Instead of a desk, she had a refectory table, bare except for a low vase filled with drooping pink and yellow roses that had opened to the full. I could see a leather-bound appointment book, a tidy row of ballpoint pens, and color-coded file folders in an upright rack. Bookshelves lined the walls on two sides, with two windows dead ahead and an exterior door that opened onto the side of the building. One arm of the walkway probably circled to the street, and the other to a parking area in the rear. If she had file cabinets, I saw no sign of them. She offered me a choice of a couch, a sleek chair of leather and chrome, or one of two chairs upholstered in a blue and green floral print. I chose one of the two matching chairs, and she elected to settle on the couch with a coffee table between us. I wondered if my selection was psychologically significant, but decided not to fret about the point. Her nails were clipped short and without polish. No wedding ring, and no other jewelry except a loose bracelet-style watch that she adjusted with her free hand. I saw her flick a practiced glance at the watch face, noting the time. She seemed open, waiting for me to set the subject and tone of the conversation. I hadn't thought about how to summarize the story, so I was forced to jump right in. Really, I should mend my careless ways. This was the third time I'd been caught without a story prepared in advance. Oh, what the hell, I thought. I'm a private detective looking for information. The story's complicated, and if I stop to spell it out, it's only going to slow us down. I thought I'd lay out the situation, and you can tell me if you need anything clarified before you reply, assuming you're willing to answer questions. "Fire away," she said. "Does the name Pete Walensky mean anything to you?" "Sure. I knew Pete. Not well, but when I heard he was shot to death, I didn't know what to think." "Is that why you're here?" "Not exactly. The police arrested the perpetrator, but the case hasn't been set for trial. What interests me is peripheral. Was he a patient of yours?" "I prefer calling them clients, but no." "Good. That's great. I'd hate asking you to violate a confidence." "No danger there," she said with a polite smile. "Can you tell me how you knew him?" "Call it old business for simplicity's sake. Our paths crossed years ago, and then he showed up again last spring. Chances were good the old business she was referring to was the lawsuit she'd filed against Ned Lowe. I nearly mentioned him, but I decided to wait, curious to see if she'd volunteer the name. So Pete initiated contact, I asked. Yep. We got together twice, with maybe 3 or 4 weeks between meetings. When I didn't hear from him again, I didn't think anything about it. When I found out he'd been killed, I was taken aback. That was a tough one, I said, my tone noncommittal. What's the nature of your interest? His widow's a friend of mine. Pete left Ruth with a pile of debt and his affairs in disarray. She's got an IRS audit coming up, so we've been going through his effects, looking for financial records. Yesterday, I found a mailing pouch concealed under a false bottom in a banker's box. The mailer was addressed to a priest in Burning Oaks, postmarked 1961. There was also a list hidden in the pages of a document in the same box. Your name was on it. What kind of list? 6 women's names, which he'd encrypted for reasons unknown. My landlord identified the cipher and provided me the key. I didn't know Pete was into cloak and dagger stuff. I guess he was, in this regard, if nothing else. She studied me. Now you're trying to determine if there's a link between the names. Exactly. Can you give me the other 5? Sure. I opened my shoulder bag and took out my index cards. I removed the rubber band and sorted through the first few until I found the notes I'd made. There's a Susan Telford in Henderson, Nevada, and a woman named Janet Macy in Tucson, Arizona. She shook her head to both. Shirley Ann Castle from Burning Oaks? I know who she is, but the reference is secondhand. I never met her myself. And the 4th? Lenore Redfern, also from Burning Oaks. There's also a Phyllis Joplin from Perdido. This is about Ned Lowe, isn't it? It's possible. I'm not sure. Back up a step. You said Pete's widow is a friend. Were you and Pete also friends? Sorry, I should have filled you in. We worked for the same detective agency many years ago. I was just starting out and needed 6,000 hours for licensing purposes. Pete was pals with Ben Bird and Morley Shine, the guys who ran the firm. To be honest, I know about the lawsuit you filed against Ned Lowe in that same time period. How long did you work there? From 1975 to 1978, when I left to open an office of my own. I thought Pete was a partner in the agency. Is that what he told you? Not directly, but that was the impression he gave. Well, it's not true. He didn't even work there full-time. He did occasional contract work. I was doing a poor job of concealing my dislike, which might have been a mistake. If she was crazy about Pete, I didn't want to put her off. Her response was mild. You say that like it's a bad thing. I don't like his distorting the facts. Ben and Morley kept him at arm's length. And why was that? I considered my reply. No reason to offend on the off chance she thought he was a model citizen. I don't see the point in going into it, I said. If you're asking about Pete, your history with him is relevant, don't you think? I entertained a small debate. If I wanted information from her, I was going to have to prime the pump. The problem was I'd have to be circumspect, which is not my strong suit. I chose my words carefully. Pete had trouble distinguishing right from wrong. He was usually hard up for cash and willing to cut corners when it came right down to it. Really? She said, bemused. He didn't strike me as morally compromised, which is what you're suggesting. Let's put it this way. What got him killed was extorting money from someone with something to hide. Maybe he was different in his dealings with you. Possible. You know, I appreciate your professional reticence, but so far this is like pulling teeth. Can we loosen up a bit? I asked. I'm trying to decide how much time and effort to expend, so a tiny bit of information would be a boon. Ask anything you like. I'll tell you what I can. I'd appreciate it. Let's start with Lenore Redfern. Am I correct in thinking Ned was married to her?
Years ago, yes. According to the story I heard, Lenny suffered postpartum psychosis after their little girl was born. When the child was 3, Lenny killed herself, and now he's married to someone else. Celeste. I ran across her name in a wedding announcement Pete clipped from the local paper.
You're talking about April's marriage, Taryn said. I saw the notice myself and remember thinking her life must be turning out okay after all.
Given her mother's suicide?
Yes.
What do you know about Shirley Ann Castle? I'm assuming she's connected to Ned in some way. As nearly as I remember, she wasn't named as a party to the lawsuit.
She wasn't. Shirley Ann was peripheral.
Meaning what in this context?
Meaning I don't want to go into it quite yet. I'm not saying I won't, but I have concerns to satisfy first.
How much do you know about the lawsuit?
Ned's attorney hired Bird Shine while I was there. You sued for intentional infliction of emotional distress, and they were asked to do a deep background check.
On me, yes. I'm painfully aware.
I thought you dropped the suit.
We reached a settlement.
Really? According to the talk around Bird Shine, you had him nailed. They were sweating bullets. Why did you back off?
Because I panicked.
When Ned's attorney... I notice I'm blanking on the name. Arnold Ruffner?
Of course. How could I forget?
When Ruffner took my deposition, he tore me apart. He had information that would have been devastating if we'd gone to trial.
Like what?
She closed her mouth and shook her head once before she went on.
Sorry to do this to you, but I've said enough for now.
That was a difficult time, and I really don't want to go into it.
When I mentioned Lenore's name and then Shirley Ann's, you jumped right to Ned. Why was that?
He grew up in Burning Oaks.
He was born there?
Don't think so. I know that's where he went to high school. Phyllis Joplin was his second wife.
Well, that's a help.
I take it you weren't the one who gave Pete the list.
He must have put that together on his own.
Do you know why?
I can make a reasonable guess, but I'd prefer not to spell it out. I hope you won't push.
Of course not. I appreciate what you've told me so far, and I want you to feel okay about sharing more. I hate the word sharing, by the way.
Oh, me too, she said, and we both smiled.
She shifted position slightly.
Is there a connection between the list and the mailer you mentioned?
Don't know yet.
Intuition says yes, but that remains to be seen. Meanwhile, it strikes me the two of us do much the same job. We study people's lives, determine what went wrong, and try to make it right. That lawsuit was 10 years ago. What harm could it do if you talked about it now?
That whole subject still makes me squirm because I blew it. It's embarrassing to admit this, but I made every mistake imaginable, starting with my attorney.
What was wrong with him?
He was kind.
Oh, boy.
Really, she said. I was an emotional mess, and he seemed so sympathetic. The minute things got rough, he gave up.
So, how much was the settlement?
I signed a confidentiality agreement, which I'd be violating if I revealed the terms. It was an ugly business. I've had to put it behind me and move on with life. I will say the settlement allowed me to finish my degree with enough left over to set up the office I'm in.
Doesn't sound like such a bad deal.
It wasn't. More importantly, I made my peace with it.
End of story.
Until Pete showed up.
To do what?
She thought about that briefly. Look, I'm not unwilling to help, but I have to protect myself. If you'll give me your phone number, I'll get back to you when I've decided what to do.
Works for me, I said. I pulled out a business card and handed it to her.
I hope you'll see your way clear.
Chapter 14. I left my car parked on the street and crossed to Sneaky Pete's. The meeting with Taryn Sizemore had been promising, but she'd have to decide how far she could trust me before we could continue our conversation.
I didn't object to her wrestling with her conscience, as long as she ponied up in the end. In the meantime, I wasn't going to pass up the consolation of a hot, gooey, spiced salami sandwich. The place was sparsely populated, a mere sprinkling of patrons. The jukebox was dark, and the television set turned off. I'd hoped to run into Con Dolan, but there was no sign of him. The bartender was reading the paper, which he laid flat on the bar in front of him. I ordered a sandwich and a Diet Pepsi. He conveyed the food order to the kitchen and then popped the top on the Pepsi can and passed it across the bar to me, along with a glass of ice. I carried both to a two-top near the front window. I took out a pen and my index cards and took notes on everything I could remember from the conversation with Ms. Sizemore. I took out the sheet of graph paper on which Pete had meticulously encoded the list of names. I put Henry's breakdown beside the original and studied the number-to-letter translation. Taryn had identified two names on the list: Lenore Redfern, Ned's first wife, and Phyllis Joplin, his second. She was apparently acquainted with the name Shirley Ann Castle, though she hadn't trusted me sufficiently to fill me in. When the sandwich arrived, I set my pen aside and ate with full attention to the gustatory joys at hand. I was home by 7:15. Henry's kitchen was dark, and I assumed he was up at Rosie's. I let myself in and checked for messages, but there was no winking red light. Ruthie's appointment with the IRS had been scheduled for 1 o'clock, and I was hoping she'd call to fill me in. I'd done what I could to help, and while she wasn't obligated to report, it would have been nice. On impulse, I leaned across the desk, picked up the handset, and punched in her number. She picked up after 3 rings. "Hey, Ruthie, it's Kinsey. How'd it go today?"
"How did what go?"
"Your appointment. I left a message earlier."
"I didn't have any messages."
"Are you sure your machine's not on the blink? I called to ask how it went with the IRS."
"Oh, he never showed."
"You can't be serious. After the horseshit he put you through?" Abruptly, Ruthie said, "Is there a chance you could get over here? Something's come up."
"I can do that."
"Are you okay? You sound odd."
"Someone's been in my house. The police just left, and I don't want to be here by myself."
"Shit. Why didn't you say so? Absolutely, I'll be right there."
I didn't break any speed laws, but I'll admit I slid through 2 stop signs and a yellow light that turned red while I was still under it. Ruthie's house was only 10 blocks away, so it didn't take me long to get there. When I pulled up in front, there were so many lights on, the place looked like it was on fire. In rooms downstairs and up, every lamp and overhead fixture was ablaze. I could see Ruthie standing at the front window, peering from behind the shears. When she spotted my car, she disappeared from sight. I didn't even have to knock because the door opened before I reached it. She grabbed my hand and pulled me inside as though I might be pursued by demons. Her face was pale and her hands were icy.
"What's going on?"
"I don't know. Maybe nothing. But I'm freaked out."
She twisted the key in the deadbolt on the front door and moved through the hall to the kitchen. I followed, looking over my shoulder in the same furtive manner she displayed. She pointed to a seat at the kitchen table where she'd set an open bottle of wine and 2 glasses, one half full and a second one empty. I settled in the chair while she poured wine for me as though I'd need to fortify myself. She pushed the glass in my direction, picked hers up, and drained it.
"What happened?"
She sat down, and then she got up again and began to pace. "When I got home from work, the back door was standing open. I will swear to you someone was in here. Not right then, but earlier. I turned around and went straight next door and called the police. 2 officers showed up 6 minutes later."
"Sounds like they took you seriously."
"They did, very much so. They were great. The older one, I think his name was Carew, could tell I was scared to death. I told him it was possible I didn't close the door all the way when I left for work, but I know I did. I always push until I hear the latch catch, and then I try the knob to make sure it's locked. Anyway, the other one, a gal named Herkowitz,
Did a complete walkthrough, checked all the doors and windows, looked in closets, looked under the beds, checked for tool marks. There was nothing. House was empty. And as far as I can tell, nothing's missing.
Well, that's good news.
You think it was kids?
Doing what?
I don't keep cash or drugs on the premises.
Addicts will break in anywhere. If neighbors know you're a nurse, someone might assume you keep narcotics on hand.
Doubtful. The medicine cabinets in both bathrooms were untouched. No drawers pulled out and dumped. No evidence that anyone tore through in search of valuables. My camera, TV set, and jewelry are all accounted for. Not that I have much.
Maybe someone was trying doors at random and found yours unlocked.
The police said the same thing. I can't rule it out, but it doesn't feel right. They wrote up an incident report and suggested I get someone in to change the locks. I called a locksmith with a 24-hour emergency service, but I haven't heard back. Who else has a house key?
My next-door neighbor's the only one with a spare. I have one for his house as well, for occasions when one or the other of us is out of town, she said.
Is it possible someone picked the lock?
Of course, it's possible, though picking locks requires more skill and practice than you'd think. You'd still have to wonder why anyone would bother.
She finished her wine and then refilled her glass. Her hands were shaking so badly she had to use both to steady the bottle while she poured. She carried the glass with her while she crossed the room and then came back to the table. I took a few sips of my own wine, hoping to quell the anxiety I was feeling in response to hers.
Why don't you give me the details?
Forget it. I'll just get all riled up again.
Come on. You'll feel better. It'll be cathartic.
What time did you get home?
I don't know, 6:30 or so.
I worked noon to 6, covering for another private duty nurse who had to be somewhere. I put the car in the garage and came in the back way like always. It wasn't till I was halfway up the back porch stairs that I realized the door was standing open, and I'm not talking ajar open. This was wide open. If my neighbor hadn't been home, I don't know what I would have done. I would not have stepped that first foot inside for any reason. Not on your life. The whole place was cold. Still is. I don't know how long the house was open. A long time. I said,
"Sit down. You're fine. Take a deep breath. You're doing great."
She sank into a chair and I covered her hands with mine.
"Look," I said, "we'll have the locksmith come in, and once he's done, you can spend the night at my place. If you stay here, you won't sleep a wink."
I won't sleep anyway. I feel like I'm hopped up on something.
Adrenaline.
Worse. Feels like my veins are full of Freon.
She put her hands between her knees and then leaned forward and put her arms around her waist, hugging herself.
"Are you feeling faint?"
She pressed two fingers to her lips and shook her head.
"Might throw up. I shouldn't guzzle wine on an empty stomach."
"You have any cheese and crackers? You should eat."
"Great idea."
She got up and opened the refrigerator, rummaged in the meat drawer, and then seemed to lose track of what she was looking for. I moved over to the kitchen counter and opened one cabinet after another until I unearthed a box of Ritz crackers that I placed on the table. I took her place at the refrigerator and found a block of cheddar while she took a cue from my action and pulled a slicer out of the utensil drawer. I took the slicer and began carving off chunks, which I mounted on crackers and passed to her in rapid succession. I couldn't help but make one for myself while I was at it. I was still chewing, holding a hand in front of my mouth lest I spray her with crumbs, as I said, "At Rosie's the other night, you mentioned the house giving you the creeps."
"I know. I remember."
She took over the cheese and cracker duties and fed herself two more, which seemed to calm her to some extent.
"Something else. I had another friend complain about my not returning calls, and it bothered me. When you said you left that first message, I shrugged it off, thinking you dialed wrong or there'd been a power outage, something like that. But then I couldn't figure out how your message and hers could just evaporate. So then I held down the play button, and brought up old messages. I had 16, which I played and deleted as fast as I could, because most I had heard but neglected to erase. Then yours popped up, and 2 from her were on there as well. I had to ask myself what the hell was going on. And the only answer I could think of was someone was in here, and listened to them first. Once you play a message, the message light no longer blinks. Which means you'd have no idea the message was ever there. That's what I concluded. You think someone was in here before the incident today? I do. On more than one occasion. She dropped her gaze and shook her head. Once it occurred to me, I realized I've had the same feeling for the past couple of weeks. Like something was off. Give me an example. Little things, nothing obvious. I'd put mail on the counter and come back later to find it not quite where it was. I'd see books leaning at odd angles in the bookcase, which is a bugaboo of mine. Or a light would be on when I distinctly remembered turning it off. I do that automatically because it's what my mother taught me. Leave a room, turn the light off. I kept dismissing and discounting my perceptions. This is bringing up the hair on the back of my neck. Well, it's scaring the shit out of me, too. Suddenly the phone rang and we both jumped. Ruthie crossed to the counter, and when she picked up, it was quickly apparent she was talking to the locksmith who'd returned her call. I disconnected my attention while she went through the exercise of explaining what had happened and what she needed done. He was available, and the two agreed to his arrival within the hour. Once she hung up, she sat down again, and I could tell she was feeling better now that help was on the way. "Why would someone do that?" I asked. "What, move things around? To spook me, I guess." It wasn't with an eye to ripping me off. There was ample opportunity for that. This was something else. Sly is the only way I can describe it. Had to be a guy. I can't picture a woman pulling the same stunt. A woman would certainly be capable, but I agree. You know what's weird? Anybody who could slip in like that could slip out again without leaving a trace. This was deliberate. It wasn't until today I felt the reality sink in. Even then, if you'd told me it was my imagination, I'd have taken your word for it. No alarm system? Well, no. When Pete was alive, we didn't need one. After he died, I could have had one installed, but I'm not used to thinking that way. The neighborhood is quiet, and it's always felt safe. It's not like we have vandals or burglars. I've checked all the windows and doors, and there's nothing out of line. Locks, window latches, everything's closed up tight. So how's this fellow getting in? We'll come over in the morning and do a proper search. I'd rather tackle it by day so we can see what we're doing. I'm not making this up, am I? Really, this is making me feel crazy. Don't worry about being crazy. I just met a good shrink and I can probably get you a discount. It took her 3 seconds to realize I was joking, and even then I knew the attempt at humor was lame. The locksmith arrived and rekeyed the front and back doors, along with a little-used side door. While Ruthie threw a change of clothes and toiletries in an overnight bag, I gave Henry a call to tell him Ruthie would be spending the night and asking if she could leave her car in his driveway. I knew I'd managed to find parking, but I didn't want her driving around in the dark in an unfamiliar neighborhood. Of course, Henry agreed. I didn't stop to explain what was going on, and he didn't press. There'd be plenty of time for that when I knew what we were dealing with. When the locksmith was finished, she wrote him a check and then walked him to the front door. After that, the two of us made the rounds, assuring ourselves that the windows and doors were secure. I followed Ruthie upstairs and walked with her from room to room, watching as she turned out the lights one by one. I was dimly aware that something was bothering me, but the immediacy of the moment required my undivided attention. The notion was like someone knocking at a distant door. Twice, I paused and turned my head as though I might identify the source. I walked with her to the garage at the rear of the property and waited while she backed her car into the alleyway. I closed the garage door after her and circled the house to the front, where my Honda was parked. Meanwhile, she'd driven along the alley and pulled around to the front,
where she eased her car in behind mine. We proceeded in a slow two-car motorcade. I kept an eye on her in my rearview mirror, noting how anxiously she scanned the darkened streets. At Henry's, I left my car with the engine running while she parked in his drive. I led her into the studio and then went back out to scout for a parking place of my own. Once that was taken care of, it didn't take long to get Ruthie settled. I keep the sofa bed made up with fresh sheets, so all I had to do was add two pillows and a quilt. At 10 o'clock, we said our goodnights, and I climbed the spiral staircase and got ready for bed. It was comforting to have someone else on the premises. I was reminded of the nights Dietz had camped out on the same sofa bed. Waking in the wee hours, if I peeked down from the loft, I'd see him reading or watching television with the sound turned so low I could have sworn it was off. I slid under the covers, and I was just about to turn out my bedside lamp when I identified the idea my subconscious had been trying to bring to my attention. I got out of bed and crossed to the railing where the loft overlooks the living room below. I could see Ruthie propped up in the sofa bed, a book open in her lap. I didn't have a chance to tell you. Henry broke the code on the number cipher Pete created. Turned out to be a list of women's names, 6 of them. She looked up. You want to come down or talk to me over the rail? I padded down the stairs, barefoot, my oversized T-shirt skimming the tops of my knees. She moved her feet so I could perch on the bottom of her fold-out bed. I could feel the bed frame through the mattress and wondered how she could bear it. I'd never had a complaint, but the supports felt like the metal struts on a sewer grate. Ruthie set her book aside. So, 6 women's names. Was mine one of them? Nope. So far, I don't think this has anything to do with you. You know who they are? The first 2 are Shirley Ann Castle and Lenore Redfern, both from Burning Oaks. The 3rd is Phyllis Joplin, who's either from Perdido or currently living there. The 4th is a psychologist named Taryn Sizemore. I talked to her. Number 5 is a woman named Susan Telford in Henderson, Nevada. The last name is Janet Macy in Tucson, Arizona. 4 are definitely connected to Ned Lowe, and I suspect the other 2 are as well.
Ned Lowe's the guy whose daughter got married. What's that about?
I'm not sure. I had a chat with Taryn this afternoon. She's the one who pointed out the link.
Name's familiar, but refresh my memory.
Oh, sorry. She's the gal who sued Ned Lowe back in 1978.
Right. I remember now.
Lenore Redfern was Ned's first wife. Phyllis Joplin was his 2nd. Taryn said she knew about Shirley Ann Castle, but that's as far as she'd go. I haven't identified the other 2, and Taryn didn't recognize the names. I'm curious why Pete put together the list of names and why he encrypted them.
Don't look at me.
He never said a word about any of this, she said.
You have a theory?
I do. But you won't like it.
Why is that relevant?
I don't want to get your dander up. I'm just playing with ideas.
Fine. Duly noted. Now get on with it.
I think Pete was collecting hush money.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Blackmail?
I knew you wouldn't like it.
Of course not.
So who's he blackmailing now? And don't say Ned Lowe. I won't say Ned Lowe, but that's what I'm thinking.
Bullshit! Don't be so defensive. Suppose it was Ned Lowe, and Pete was pressuring him. Pete's killed, and at first the guy thinks he's safe and everything's good. Then he gets worried Pete had something that would prove incriminating if it ever came to light.
But why Ned Lowe in particular? As far as I know, Pete never even met the man. You can't be sure of that, and neither can I. Pete kept a lot of information to himself. The point is, he was working for Bird Shine when the lawsuit was filed. It was their job to find dirt on Taryn Sizemore, which apparently they did. Pete might have learned something just as damning about Ned Lowe. The list is a roster of women, and I believe all of them are tied to Ned Lowe in some way. Girlfriends, wives, romantic interests would be my guess. What I don't know is why the list constitutes a threat.
Pure speculation.
Of course it is. On the other hand, if Pete blackmailed one victim, why not 2?
Why are you always so quick to put him in the wrong?
I'm not. I'm just trying to construct an explanation for all the bits and pieces.
Sorry to disappoint you, but I'm not buying it.
You don't have to be so cranky.
I'm not cranky.
Good. Fine. May I continue then?
Have at it.
Taryn Sizemore sued Nedlow for stalking and threats. Intentional infliction of emotional harm, to use the proper legal term. Maybe Pete found out more about Lowe than he should have.
You said the lawsuit was dead.
It is. But what if Lowe turned out to be vulnerable in some other way? What if Pete had evidence that was damaging?
Like what? She said, exasperated.
I don't know. Maybe Lowe doesn't know either. My point is, Pete had something on the guy.
Can you hear yourself? Do you see how unfair you're being?
In your view, if something bad went down, Pete must have been at the heart of it, hoping to make a buck.
I'm not accusing him of anything.
Yes, you are. You're suggesting he had the goods on Nedlow and was extorting money to keep quiet.
That's not exactly unprecedented in Pete's repertoire of bad behavior. She held a hand up.
Enough. I'm tired. I've had a hard day. We could talk about this tomorrow. Right now, I'm turning off the light.
Which is what she did. I sat for a moment, nonplussed, and then padded back up the spiral stairs, got into bed, and turned out my own light. I knew she was angry, but I felt curiously unaffected. So she was pissed off, big deal. I still thought the idea had merit. She must have thought so too, or why get so bent out of shape?
Chapter 15. In the morning, I slipped out of the studio before Ruthie was up and got in my 3-mile run. By the time I returned, bringing in the morning paper, the sofa bed was made up and she was in the shower. I put out a pot of coffee and set out the milk, a box of Cheerios, 2 bowls, and 2 spoons. I turned on the television set with the sound muted. When she emerged from the bathroom, showered and dressed, we ate our cereal while we passed sections of the paper back and forth. I noticed she'd repacked her overnight bag, which was now resting by the front door.
You sure you don't want to stay one more night?
Don't think so. I'll sleep better in my own bed.
I can relate to that, I said. Pete's name was never mentioned, and neither of us made reference to our little chat the night before. This is not a bad strategy. The practice of bearing all, analyzing every nuance embedded in a quarrel, is a surefire way to keep an argument alive. Better to establish a temporary peace and revisit the conflict later. Often, by then, both parties have decided the issue isn't worth the relationship. As we were preparing to leave for Ruthie's, Henry appeared on my doorstep. He was still in the dark about this latest development, so I gave him a quick rundown on the intruder and the changing of the locks. We're on our way over to her house now to see if we can figure out how the guy got in. Henry was shaking his head.
Terrible.
All's good with you? I asked.
Actually, I have to go out shortly, and I was going to ask you to move your vehicle so I can get my marketing done.
She held up her car keys. I'm on it, champ. He turned to me.
I wonder if I might have a word with you. It won't take 2 shakes.
Ruthie picked up her overnight bag. I'll go on over in my car, and you can follow in yours when it suits. You're okay going in the house on your own. She waved away the idea.
If I get nervous, I'll wait for you on the back porch.
Once she pulled out, Henry held up a handwritten list. This may not work if you're going to be at Ruthie's for any length of time. I told Edna I'd take her to the market, but Joseph's not feeling well, and since she only needs a few items, I said I'd do her shopping along with mine. The problem is I have a plumber coming this morning between 10 and noon, and I'm not sure how long I'll be gone. I was wondering if you could be here when the guy arrives. If I'm not back, you can show him around. I've already told him what I need, but you may have to answer questions about hose bibs or sprinkler heads.
Sure. I'll make a point of being back by 9:45, and I'll hang out until you get home.
Ruthie had pulled her car into her garage while I parked mine along the rear property line. I retrieved a flashlight from the glove compartment, locked the car, and followed the back walk to the porch, doing a cursory visual survey in the unrelenting morning light. The house probably dated back to the early 1900s, a story and a half of wood frame bereft of the usual gingerbread trim that might have lent it some character. The structure was serviceable, incorporating all of the relevant elements, minus style, personality, and appeal. I tapped at the door, and she let me in. Aside from my brief visit the night before, I hadn't been in the house in months, and I was struck by its shabbiness. Pete hadn't been blessed with handyman talents, so if something needed repairing, either Ruthie took care of it or it was left in its funky state. Pete had also been averse to hiring outside help because his pride prevented his admitting that even the simplest job was beyond his poor skills. To spare him, Ruthie had learned to make do. Drawer handles were missing. In the kitchen window, cracked wood putty had pulled away from the glass and short sections were gone. The vinyl tile flooring in the kitchen had buckled in places, as though water had seeped in and loosened the underlying mastic. Now that Ruthie was alone, what difference did it make? Pete's clutter was gone, so the house was tidier. She'd also removed the stained and threadbare area rugs in the downstairs hall and waxed the pale hardwood floors to a high shine. She'd removed a drawer and placed it on the counter where she'd unloaded the contents. She'd been sorting the miscellany and tossing the discards in a wastebasket. She'd bought drawer dividers to organize the salvageable items. "I'll put some coffee on," she said. "Don't mind the mess. I decided to tackle some of Pete's crapola." "A good idea," I said. "Mind if I go ahead and look around?"
"Please."
I dropped my shoulder bag on a chair and shoved my flashlight in my back pocket while I made a circuit of the first floor, checking window latches, locks, and door hardware. Ruthie had made the same search the night before, and she'd sworn the house was secure, which did seem to be the case. I climbed the stairs to the second floor, peering out of windows as I moved through a small guest bedroom with an adjoining bathroom, a hallway, and a second bedroom currently used for storage. This must be the junk room. Ruth had relegated miscellaneous furniture, hanging clothes, and seasonal items to the 10-by-12-foot space. There were also short stacks of assorted cardboard boxes, with scarcely room to walk in between. The wallpaper was pink and blue, with tiny floral bouquets tied with ribbons.